It was just that case. It was built fine, failed badly in application, and the designer was blaming the assembler for a field reliability issue when they had fundamentally, you know, picked wrong materials for a very hostile environment. And so, you know, arguing about who's really at fault there and who should have known.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Altium On Track podcast. I am here talking today with Cheryl Tolkov, an electronics reliability consultant and overall QA guru, and formerly working at a number of well-known companies. And I think this is going to be a really great conversation looking at QA, QC, and PCB manufacturing and some of the things that designers should know as they make that transition to higher volumes. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you used to work at, we were talking beforehand, but you used to work at National Instruments, and I first recall seeing your name from your work at DFR Solutions, and I remember seeing your name on a number of technical papers looking at reliability. Maybe if you have a moment, you could tell the audience about your background and how you got into how you became to be a reliability consultant.
Well, it's definitely been a long, interesting, and rewarding path. So, by background, I'm a mechanical engineer from Georgia Tech, but I really started my career in electronics from the beginning. So, right out of college, I relocated to Austin, going to work for IBM at the time when IBM was first making laptops, PS2s, still making mainframes, and it was a really neat time. IBM was really vertically integrated, and so Austin had everything. We had bare board manufacturing, we had printed circuit board assembly and test, we had reliability, we had box build, as well as chip fabrication and design. So it was a great way to really get immersed in electronics manufacturing from beginning to end. And so that's how I got my start. And, you know, from there, also had the opportunity to work inside a fab, doing failure analysis at the die level, and then, of course, working for National Instruments. And then with DFR, what that really brought was the ability to, you know, kind of bring everything together and really focus on reliability and quality, which I found really fascinating. It's still a pretty small group of people that kind of specialize in this area. And, you know, through DFR, you know, I got a chance to take all these skills and then apply them across different industries. So there we were doing, you know, consulting really to everyone, defense, medical, aerospace, consumer electronics. And so you get to see all the different ways in which people use the same types of things and the different ways in which they fail based on their environment.
That's interesting. So starting at IBM, you said you got to see really everything from beginning to end, but it's not just the PCB assembly. It's, I mean, you mentioned they had, you know, chip fabrication. So, I mean, really right down to the bare bones of what we use every day, which is, of course, integrated circuits.
Absolutely.
And so looking at it, you know, looking at the entire, I guess, the entire process for getting to an electronic product, you must see a lot of potential failures that we don't really see as designers unless we're like literally testing this stuff all the time.
Yeah, that's true. And that's, I think, really one of the neat things about, you know, being able to work in all these different areas of printed circuit board assembly processes. And seeing sometimes the misalignment, right? So if you think back to, you know, chip manufacturing or those processes versus the assembly processes, even today, the standards and the way they're qualified are different at the chip level than at the board level, and then, of course, at the system and environment level. And so there's some inherent gaps in the system, even from the get-go, that even if you were doing everything according to the playbook, if you will, there's still things to learn there. So it's a pretty fascinating, you know, look, and that's, you know, one of the things that I find, you know, really inspiring is the ability to kind of look at those gaps and help people, you know, at least avoid the pitfalls we've solved already, especially across industries. You tend to be lots of silos in this business, and so it's, you know, giving people that perspective or awareness that you don't have to reinvent or resolve every problem. Let's look for the new things, the new stressors.
So you know you said that the standards by which I guess, reliability is quantified, if you will, or assessed in these different levels of an electronics assembly, whether it's, you know, the chip, and there's probably something totally different for components that are not integrated circuits, and then the assembly itself. All of those things are siloed, and I would agree with you. I only agree because I don't know all of the standards for integrated circuits, and I certainly don't know all the standards for all the different components. You know, in working with a client, I might hear a few, you know, alphanumeric strings that I then realize, oh, that's a technical standard from somewhere. But why is that all siloed? I mean, is it really just that those reliability problems are so siloed themselves that it makes sense to have these individual, you know, kind of very siloed standards? Or is there really a need to kind of standardize across these different domains?
Well, it's a little bit of both. There are definitely areas where it makes complete sense to have, you know, unique or non-aligned standards and ways of testing and evaluating things. And that comes down to, you know, how things are going to be used, right? One of the things I think is really fascinating is this convergence, how you see electronics in everything now. You know, it's not just the high-tech things, it's day-to-day life. Even refrigerators now, like my refrigerator is, you know, on Internet of Things. I get updates from it and it tells me when the filter needs to be changed. And so you electronics have become mundane in that they're in literally everything we touch, and they don't all need to be built to the same standards, right? What's important for reliability of your watch versus your refrigerator versus your heart implant versus a satellite are very different. And so, you know, you don't want necessarily a one size fits all, but, you know, what you also see is that all these industries are trying to use the same components off the shelf or COTS, right, to the same thing. They want to try to minimize cost. And that's fine, but as designers and as test engineers, reliability experts, we need to help those people understand some of the risks inherent in that, how you can design around that, how you can test, or how you can mitigate some of the risk if you choose to go down that path. And so that's where, you know, some of that misalignment naturally happens. So even at the component level, you know, something could be designed for consumer electronics but end up in a vehicle. But there are things that those people do to ensure that that component will survive that way versus buying something that might be inherently more expensive but built to a higher standard.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, you're saying something like, I'm just going to throw a name out here. You're saying something like an Arduino that maybe isn't, you know, meant for high reliability, production grade, you know, equipment ending up in a system that, you know, someone's life could depend on. I mean, is that the level of modularity that people are trying to achieve and then creating reliability
absolutely.
Problems because of it?
Well, yeah, it's not always problems. So you know, that's what you can safely do those things if you understand the risks inherent in it and design, mitigate appropriately for it. And you know, that's really one of the, I think, really neat spaces that's a little under-resourced in the industry is the whole risk assessment, risk mitigation, risk-based thinking. You know, the standards like ISO standards and the quality standards have really use that as the core tenet. You know, think about what you're designing and look at the risks and then manage them appropriately, because you can use those, but they require different test methods, different evaluation methods, different things to ensure that it's going to have the lifetime and reliability you need. If you don't do nothing, then of course you're setting yourself up for potential failure.
So I have to wonder here, you know, to what extent you start to see companies go down this path that you're talking about and not be able to anticipate the potential problems that they'll run into, and they just jump into these design decisions, whether it's, you know, cost driven, let's say they want to minimize cost and this is the cheapest path forward, or maybe it's market pressure, right? Our competitors are already to market.
Supply chain.
Perfect point. Yeah, supply chain. We can't build this ourselves, but we can buy this off the shelf. So let's just buy this off the shelf. I mean, how often do you see companies run into reliability problems because they fail to anticipate those potential failures that could arise from their design choices?
Absolutely. It does happen. And, you know, I mentioned supply chain is just one of the things that's been impacting the industry dramatically, right? The availability of the components that you do want, you know, do you choose not to proceed if you can't get a specific component because, you know, it's just simply not available or you can't get it in time. But, you know, that's where the risk assessment and the test evaluation things come in, and where, sadly, one of the things that is, and I guess it's kind of a cultural and industry thing as well, too, is that we're hopelessly optimistic, right? If you see like a typical design plan or test plan, they always plan for success, right? If you look at it, if you look at a typical company, they have all these phases and gates through the design process and sign-offs and tests that are run, and you're looking for a specific outcome. And it's always like, yep, we're going to do this test. It's going to pass the next gate, you know, and there's typically not enough time or budget left to do failure analysis or if something goes wrong, how to recover. And so that's where I typically see the mistakes happen. They get to one of these, they have a failure, and now they're up against a commitment, a budget, a customer need, and now they're like, well, where can I cut? And so typically the first thing that gets cut is some part of a test or some part of a quality plan, and that's where you typically see the most common forms. Because companies have gotten really good at doing like design FMEAs or failure modes, effects, and analysis. And so those have become part of kind of the general practice, especially in high reliability. The challenge is to do those with a fully functional group, cross-functional people who can help identify risks you might not think of.
That's really interesting, because what you just said about planning for success, that's, now that you've actually said that, and it immediately got me thinking about engagements that I've had with other companies. And you're absolutely right. Their roadmaps are always success driven. There is never a contingency or a, you know, what if this thing that we want to build doesn't work. Even right down with like front end engineering and having to do like simulations. Like, we're doing something totally new. We need to go through a round of simulations. It's going to take X number of days. But what if that thing that you think you're simulating and is going to work perfectly doesn't actually work? It's kind of this, I'm hearing the parallel here now with reliability on the back end. Once you actually go to build something and then try and take it to market, what if that doesn't work? How do companies manage the potential for failure? Because if everybody is so optimistic and thinking this is our roadmap and we're sticking to it, you know, of course everybody is surprised and, you know, has their hair on fire as soon as something doesn't go to plan. How do companies manage that NPI process when failure is probably inevitable somewhere?
Yeah, I think and the industry has gotten so much better at this in the past couple of years, is embracing and actually celebrating failure. You know, there's long, and there still is, obviously, a stigma against failing. But I know at the companies I've worked at, you know, there was an active, you know, movement to say, hey, you know, you're pushing boundaries here. Expect failure. You know, no one gets things right the first time. You know, if you are, that probably means you're not pushing yourself hard enough, right? If you, everything you try works great immediately, you're probably doing things that are a little too easy or that have been done before. And so, you know, part of that is actually saying, yes, okay, it's good. We've learned something. And we were expecting that. We've planned for it. Now, how do we resolve it and move on? And so that's been, I think, a really neat shift to see. And there's been a lot of media articles and writing about, you know, trying to accept that failure should be embraced and celebrated for the learning opportunity that it truly is.
What's the expression, fail hard and learn fast, I think is the expression. I've heard that before.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple around it. You know, the first is fail fast, and you know, the other one is don't make the same mistake twice, right?
Oh, yeah.
which is what I see and you know, kind of feel bad about in the reliability world, is that you get it the first time, you know, when you're trying. But once it's been solved, you know, share that information and don't make that mistake again. Don't have it happen on another product line or another area because you weren't paying attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think... You know, going back to product roadmaps or, you know, setting milestones for projects for just a moment, in order to account for what is possibly going to be a failure, I mean, what does that look like in a milestone? Is it just like we secretly extend out those anticipated completion dates in order to account for the fact that we might have to do it twice because we failed at something somewhere along the way?
Yeah, there are a couple of practices that can really help with that. You know, the first is obviously understanding that, you know, failure should be part of your design planning process, right? You need to have it in there, you need to budget for it and allocate for it. But some of that also comes down to basic project management best practices, right? You know, in a lot of places, you know, it's X number of days and a date. And the reality is it's a range, right? You know, any given phase gate could have, you know, a date plus or minus X number of days, a budget plus or minus. And you can actually model that based on your experience at the companies. You know, what is your typical kind of schedule look like? How often do you go over and under those kind of postmortems in your project where you can actually set those up? Or you can use some of the tools that are built into, you know, most of the really good project planners now will help you, you know, do that kind of simulation that gives you boundaries and, you know, helps kind of set the stage a little bit better so you don't get into this absolute crunch and then you have no way out or you didn't plan for it. Now you've got to figure out how to, you know, afford it and what the implications are be. And that's really where the risk analysis part comes in as well too, right? Is that beforehand, you know, okay, if something fails, you know, do I have the labs lined up? Do I have the extra parts needed? Do I have the people? You know, just putting those things in a plan so that if that does happen, you've got a ready-to-go action that you can jump on rather than then having to stop and not even have a clue as to how to proceed.
This is one of those things that I have seen startups run into where they're overly optimistic and they probably were always on time at their previous corporate job, you know, doing engineering or NPI or whatever it is. So I think they're used to succeeding, but then they get into something where they're having to build an advanced piece of hardware, and then all of a sudden, supply chain bites them, or all of a sudden, the thing they thought they were going to build, the simulation says otherwise, or their prototype says otherwise. Now they've got to go back to the drawing board. They're totally off their project roadmap, or, you know, they're going to miss that that meeting with that VC who's going to fund them for the next 10 years or whatever the case may be. And it's actually more common than I think startup founders would like to admit, especially if this is their first jump into hardware. And I'm actually seeing that a lot more often. The startup founders that I've met most recently, they actually come from software and they're jumping into hardware for the first time. And this whole idea of, like, it's a physical thing, like, it can fail, seems foreign at first until they, like, actually produce their first prototype and something doesn't work.
Oh, my gosh, you raised, like, six fascinating points in there. It's like, where to begin unpacking that one. So first, you know, the startup culture, you know, the pressures there are obviously real, right? When you're literally looking at survival mode, what you're trying to do, and so... Yeah.
Well, on top of that, there's another cost pressure there because in that, like, if it's just you or you and a partner, like, it's probably your money. And so, yeah. You know, forget about the VCs for a second. Like, this is my life savings I'm putting into this. Like, this has to work.
Yeah. And so the pressure is phenomenal. It's actually, I found that space so interesting. I went back to grad school in 2015 at UT Austin in a program specifically around technology commercialization that was kind of, you know, attempting to address those types of things. You know, how do you launch successfully? How do you make these partnerships? And, you know, it's a fascinating space, you know, for startups because you want to nurture because you don't know, you know, where those next great fantastic things are come from, but how do you do that smartly and successfully? And so that's where I really think some of the future and modeling really helps. When you think about some of the tools that we have out there now that can do a lot of things before you start to invest a lot of money in physical hardware and is it even capable of doing what I want to do and what are some of the risks? And then you also mentioned software, and I find that fascinating because the electronics world typically has been kind of hardware focused and hardware failure focused in particular too, is that if something goes wrong, it's got to be the hardware, right? And so we've got lots of practices and standards around hardware and not so much around software. And if you look today, there's every electrical or electronic kind of device or system is really an integration. Nothing runs without software anymore. And so software reliability, software quality is a big thing, and it's an even smaller group who specialize and focus in that area, and it's very underrepresented as a reason for failure of systems. And so it's interesting to see, you know, as more of these things come together, how we get better at looking for software faults rather than focusing as that as a hardware thing, and what those folks with that background can do to successfully integrate systems together and also learn about, you know, the challenges of being in a hardware space.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's almost this assumption that if you're the hardware person, it's like the software person gave it to me, so it must work. They must have done whatever magic they do in code to ensure that all the logic is correct. And I get the binary,
that's
I flash it on.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, it could be. I mean, I was dealing something with a I was dealing with a project a few months ago where we didn't actually know if like the hardware was defective, if we had made a design mistake somewhere, if we just had defective components because we had to get them overseas, and you know, there's that whole risk associated with it. And, you know, non-authorized distributors and all that. So there's always that question mark of, did they give us something bogus? Or is it, did the vendor give us an old version of the firmware that is out of date, that was wrong to begin with? And, you know, there's all these question marks. And, you know, at some point we had no way of verifying. We just kind of had to take the vendor at their word that, no, this software is correct. This is correct. You got it from us. It's correct. Don't worry about it. It's your hardware. It's your problem.
Yeah, there's a lot of finger pointing, you know, that happens, you know, when that system integration comes together. And that's really, I think, where there's a lot of opportunity in the design space to improve some of the techniques. And another great place for modeling, right? I think earlier you had mentioned, you know, how do you assess risk when you're trying something that's never been done before, right? How do you think of the scenarios under which things could go wrong and how you might respond to them? And yeah, that's very real, right? And that's where, you know, sometimes the modeling may create ridiculous situations, but it can also help identify those things that people really didn't conceive of or couldn't think of, like, oh, that would never happen, or I didn't think of that, and you know, inject those faults into the testing sequence and try it out. Because anymore, you know, you're never going to try every possible thing that could happen in a system, right? You never get a product out the door looking at every potential way it could or couldn't be used or misused as well, and then add in counterfeiting and supply chain and other things that are going on, and you've got, you know, this just incredibly complex suite of parameters that you're trying to control or think about.
Yeah. Okay, so you brought up a couple of things that are interesting here for the designer engineer who's trying to maybe do something totally new and innovative, and they want to assess that risk. So I think simulations are an important part of it. If you like, especially if it's, you know, electromagnetics or, you know, even mechanical, right? You brought up FMEA. Those types of tools to qualify the physical design on the front end before you produce a prototype. So is that something that that you think design teams or engineers or even just startups will have to rely on more in order to properly assess that risk? Or is it still like, hey, we're going to produce this prototype, we're going to stress it till it breaks, find out why it broke and update it, and we're going to get to a viable product that way? Is that still the path forward? I'd like to hear your thoughts here, because at some point they're going to try and scale, and they may need to come talk to you. And I think you might want to know what they did on the front end to try and assess the reliability.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's always going to be a need for both, right? And again, this comes back to what your risk tolerance is and what you're designing for as to what percentage you can rely on for modeling and then how much you really need to spend on the physical side as well, too, because you're never going to be able to model with modeling only for a medical device or space device. I mean, there's just simply, you've got to do physical testing with prototypes and real things, but there is a lot that you can do that in the modeling side that can help reduce that amount, how many samples you might need, how much you have to spend, or how far along the design process you have to be before you uncover anything. And that's really where the modeling really helps tailor and reduce cost and speed up your efforts. It's not a replacement for hardware testing, but it certainly can help things and help drive some understanding that helps you be more mindful of where you spend your money and how long it's going to take you to do things.
Well, I almost think of like the front end simulation as like your baseline expectation. They set the bar for what you should expect to see in terms of operation, but possibly also help you identify something that you might want to test later when you actually do produce something physical, right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, maybe your intuition or industry standard says you need to test A, B, and C, but then simulation comes along and says you need to actually also test D, E, and F.
Or further out in this direction, or, another combination of factors. You know, one of the biggest challenges that I kind of see routinely in working with clients and companies is that, you know, quality and reliability can be very nebulous to people. Everybody says, oh, I need high reliability or I want high quality. But you need to put some definition behind that, right? Is what are you designing for? How long does it have to last? What failure rate is tolerable? Because you see so many people kind of jump right in, you know, without a clear understanding of that. And those drive very different behaviors in design, in component selection, in the assembly processes. And so if you don't go in with a well-defined target to achieve, you know, how do you know if you've been successful and how do you really get there? And that's where I see things go wrong or things go under budget or not work as intended, is they weren't clear on what they really needed. And, you know, we're just trying to hit a target or a budget thing without understanding some of the trade-offs there.
So I think reliability is probably a little bit easier to quantify or define than quality, because with reliability, I can say, I know that this board could possibly receive a mechanical shock of this force, let's say, or I know it could potentially be exposed to this much of a thermal shock, let's say, right? Those are things that I can put a number to it, and then if I had the resources, I could throw it in a simulator, or I could take it to a test facility with an actual prototype and then test it. So I think those things are easier to define. But how do you define quality?
It's such a fascinating topic all by itself, is just distinguishing the difference between quality and reliability. And there is no one answer because it depends on the industry. What is good quality and high reliability for a toy would not be acceptable for an automobile. And so first, there's a lot of it depends. And there's also a lot of confusion between the terms as well, too, because something can be built with high quality, meaning defect-free, that's completely reliable in its end application. And so they can be completely divorced as well, too, right? You picked the cheapest part and everything, and it was built, and it tests perfectly, but, you know, it was intended to operate in a really stressful environment and falls apart, you know, after the first, you know, summer that it's had a have hot temperature exposure or something. And so, reliability is that concept of the end use environment and time being part of it. And quality is really the point in time versus that duration out there. And so first is kind of trying to come to grips with how they're different, and then how they're different for industries in the in-use environment as well.
Let me ask you this. So when I was a little background first. So several years ago, looking for a job before I started, doing design professionally. I was interviewing as a quality engineer for an aerospace company, and it felt like the conversation centered a lot around yield, however you're going to define that. And then they like wanted to teach me statistical process control. And like in my head at the time, that's what it felt like quality was. You're doing statistical process control to try and make sure that yield gets to as close to 100% as possible. Is that the right way to think about quality in terms of electronics manufacturing? Or is there something deeper?
Yeah, there's a lot more to it than that. So obviously those are key elements when you talk about statistical process control, first pass yield or end yield. You know, those are important elements in reducing defects.
So there's different types of yield.
Oh, yes, there are definitely different types of yield. So first, you know, they are first pass yield is the first kind of the yield, everything tested the first time. But, you know, something, if you find an error and it gets repaired, you know, then there are other throughput yields. There are different ways of defining yield as well, too, in the industry. But, you know, when you think about SPC and the types of things you're describing, that's defect reduction. There's a whole other element of quality that's kind of the forward-looking or the prevention to begin with, too, that are important elements as well. So it's not just how you find and reduce variation, but how you take that and then prevent it from happening to begin with. That's another part. And that's where some of the design plays a key role in that, because as designers, the types of components you select, the way you lay them out on the board, can make it very difficult to achieve a high first pass yield, no matter how good the factory is in terms of their process abilities and their process control. And so there's a lot of interaction in there between the design process and the actual yield process. And so quality is really that a combination of a lot of factors, right? The design, the partnership that you have, the tools and processes you have, how heavily it can be automated. And that's one of the exciting things about all these new sensors now is we've got all this data to reduce variation and control, but still, if someone's, you know, done a poor design job, you know, there's only so much you can do to overcome that.
And I think if you're a designer, some of this, you're kind of, you know, separated from some of this. There's a big buffer in between you and then the kind of things you're talking about with quality sometimes, because you know, not all designers work at an OEM, and not all designers work for a manufacturer, let's say, either as, you know, handling designs for clients or maybe in the CAM department or wherever else. They're, you know, external vendors. They're design firms. That's all they do. They create the design data, they hand it off, and they don't even cross their fingers and hope it works. It's like, okay, I gave you what you asked for, that's it, right? And they're out of there. So if someone's on the front end in that situation and they're working to create something that is going to eventually scale and go through this kind of battery of reliability assessments that we've been referencing, what's their role? What can they do? Or does their role just end at some point and it's all on the manufacturer beyond that to ensure reliability?
Well, first I'll say the manufacturer cannot ensure reliability for you at all. So you can...
Love it.
you know, there's no amount of money that you're going to be able to pay that will, you know, make a reliable product out of a poor design, no matter how good the OEM is. They really have very little control over that. They control the quality piece, and ideally, you have a relationship with them. You know, so the best thing to do, and you mentioned it earlier, is most designers anymore don't really have a lot of experience in the factory or the production processes. We've separated that out. You know, designers are, you know, even in one part of the world, and there are, you know, manufacturers in other, and they may have never seen it or understand it. They're optimizing their design for the design purposes, not necessarily for the full life or the buildability. But you know, the best thing to do is first to educate themselves on what it is and really partner. You know, if you know you're going to be building something physical and you're not doing it yourself, your own company, you've got the partner out there. Work with them early in the design process. Don't wait till the end when you know you think you've got your finished product and like, you know, fling it over the wall and, you know, fingers crossed, the hope for the best, right? It's too late then. You know, you want to move on to other things, and changing the design or components can be very challenging. So this really needs to be an early involvement and a partnership if you really want to make an affordable and reliable design. Because you just see that so frequently. It's like, well, you know, the contract manufacturer will take care of that. You know, they will, and it'll cost you more. And they can do the quality piece, but you know, if you've inherently not chosen an appropriate type of package or a PCB laminate for your in-use environment, they can build it great. Again, it'll be perfect quality and completely unreliable for your in-use application.
And so in terms of like what a designer can do, I guess not everybody works with directly with the manufacturer. Right. So I think at some point they end up relying on standards. Right. And so like class three, you know, IPC class two, class three. Right. Those are some definite things that are at least intended to help ensure certain levels of reliability. How well do you think designers can rely on standards and then just say, well, we built it to this spec, you know, as specified in the standard, it should be just fine. What's wrong with that thinking, and where does the spec start to fail? I see a big smile on your face. So.
Oh, yeah, because that question comes up so many times, right? And I do think standards play a great role in helping prevent the known problems. But when you look at standards and some of the challenges with relying on them is that first they lag in time. And so if you are a designer and you're trying something new or pushing boundaries, the standards are not going to help you. You know, the problems haven't been discovered yet, they haven't been documented, and so they're always going to be behind the curve. And then second, if you look at how industry standards are kind of put together and compiled, it's volunteer-based, and it's representative of an entire industry. And so again, what is great and agreeable in the consumer space is much different in, you know, a higher reliability like space or transport or medical devices. And so they also become minimal, kind of ground level. So just because you pass the bare minimum does not mean that you're going to have a greater reliable product, which is why you see some of the differentiation in IPC standards as well as in ISO standards, where they have extra things that add on if you're in aerospace or medical. But they're always going to be behind the times and not necessarily representative of your particular needs or applications.
So in terms of the role of someone like yourself, reliability consultant, when does that come into play? Do people contact, or maybe not individual designers, but do manufacturers or OEMs contact someone like yourself once they have a problem with an assembly and, you know, everyone's pulling out their hair trying to figure out why this thing won't work? Or do you see companies actually being proactive and thinking about this ahead of time? Or is it a case kind of like we've just said, where it's like, well, we did the bare minimum, meaning, you know, we designed it to the spec, and what's wrong? We don't understand why this is going on.
So, you know, I see companies all across the spectrum. It's more heavily weighted toward the failure side, which is a little bit sad as a professional, right? Is that it's always one of those things, you know, we mentioned earlier during the design process, how little time or acknowledgement there is that things might fail. And so, oh, we'll bypass some of these things or move on. But we always find the money and the resources when something's broken catastrophically to go do something about it. So we try to shift that upstream. And so I do see a lot of places where it's like, we thought we did everything right and it broke. Why? Can you help us figure it out? Where did we go wrong? But we also, or I also have the chance to work with a lot of companies at the design stage, you know, doing design reviews very early on, even concept stage, first helping frame what am I designing for? How long? What is the risk? You know, what do I need as a reliability target? And then here's my concept design. Are there things that we could do to improve manufacturability? Can I move components, create some spacing, plug some vias, you know, whatever. There's a, you know, a whole litany of things that you can do that can reduce the opportunity for errors in manufacturing if you're involved early. So it, you know, it can be anywhere, and lots of companies recognize that, and they hire those things out because they don't necessarily need that skill full-time, depending on the amount of designs they do. And it's also a pretty specialized field as well, too. So, you know, again, I see them at all kinds of things, unfortunately, but we're at the back end and sometimes even litigating, you know, when things have gone badly awry.
Wow. So you mentioned litigating. Have you ever actually had to be an expert witness?
I have, and it, you know, several times, and actually had to testify in court for one that actually didn't get settled, which was a pretty fascinating experience, you know, to kind of be involved in. And it's also really sad because, you know, what I think one of the things that have in common is that failure to set expectations. And you mentioned earlier thinking that the manufacturer is going to be able to guarantee your reliability. And that was one of them, which was a you know, it was just that case. It was built fine, failed badly in application, and the designer was blaming the assembler for a field reliability issue when they had fundamentally, you know, picked wrong materials for a very hostile environment. And so, you know, arguing about who's really at fault there and who should have known.
Really? So the person who is responsible for picking materials in terms of assembly, so it sounds like solder in this case.
Well, in this case, it was a laminate based okay. issue, and the designer had, you know, said, this is what I want, and, you know, that's what okay. the assembler gave them, and it just wasn't appropriate for their in-use application, so they built it fine. It just didn't hold up well.
I see. So, again, failure at the designer level to anticipate what the demands are in the end application.
Or, you know, there was an element of that, but there's also the element, too, of sometimes, you know, again, that idea of the partnership, as if you're going to pick an OEM or contract manufacturer, you know, to make your device, consulting with them on material selection, right, too, because sometimes they're like, oh, well, I read about this great thing, and I want X on my product, when X wasn't really intended for that use environment. And so sometimes you'll see they're in their desire to be very precise in what they want on their design, they design it so that, you know, it's really not the right thing. If they had spoken to someone about their end use or availability, they might have gotten some recommendations on something that'd be more appropriate. But yeah, they're like, oh, well, I'm going to name it to get exactly what I want. They got that. It just didn't work out great.
Is that the type of thing that could have been identified early on with, you know, environmental, functional, some kind of testing with a batch of prototypes? Or was this a sample size issue? You know, a prototype batch would have just been too few to even have noticed it.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that the failure ended up causing some incident that then needed to be litigated later.
Yeah, the challenge with this one is I don't think it would have shown up in typical prototype testing because of both sample size and both on the difficulty of finding this particular failure mode that was occurring. So this particular one, it was a failure mode called CAF, filament formation within the PCB. It's very difficult to find and debug to begin with, and certainly in small sample sizes. And so I think it would be a challenge. But that's where some of the modeling software and just knowing about the rules of practice with spacing of conductors and relative voltage potential differences between them and the type of laminate you choose, you know, knowing those things, you know, that risk was there for this environment and the choices they made, they just weren't aware of it.
I think this is one of those issues where there is a standard for it, But there's a big asterisk with a bunch of context next to the standard
Yes.
that you
A
have
lot
to
of it
understand.
depends. Yes.
Right. Yeah, so I think designers educating themselves a little bit more, almost on the failure modes themselves, is really more valuable than just, you know, knowing the standard ahead of time, because I think I'm agreeing with you that, you know, standards are helpful, but they're not the thing that's going to make your product immune to reliability problems. It's almost as if understanding the failure modes a little bit better can maybe help you make some smarter design decisions, like what we're talking about, picking the right laminate to suppress CAF.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's always about knowing that in-use environment, right? What types of things you need to be worried about and how you might find them, right? Back to that idea of the risk assessment, you know, knowing, you know, is it going to have corrosive agents, or is it going to be condensing, or, you know, will there be water, temperature? Knowing those things, you know, kind of makes you think about how you might test differently, or where you're vulnerable and what you can tolerate, and if you need redundancy or something like that. There's, again, back to that concept of you got to know what you're designing for to be successful at it.
Yeah, and then with redundancy, the only time I hear anyone talk about redundancy is in space, which is, I mean, I just wrapped up an engagement with a client recently, but, you know, they work in commercial space, and like every time we would talk, you know, go over and do design reviews and, you know, talk about system architecture and stuff like that, it was like, oh yeah, that's going to be redundant. There's going to be another board on the actual system. I'm not going into what the system is, but there's going to be another board that in case this one fails, we have a second one.
Yeah, redundancy, you know, can come in a number of different forms too, because, you know, some people think of it as just having entirely, you know, duplicate system or backup, but, you know, there are other industries in which, you know, redundancy has become quite common in different ways and to do it. So think about data centers, you know, mm-hmm. the internet these days on and how much uptime and reliability, you know, they want you know, that your access to have to websites and things, people like Amazon and Google who are in that space among many smaller players. And so, you know, whether that's power supplies and fans and the typical things that they're looking at or parallel banks, you know, and then location. So you think where data centers are located, so they're not vulnerable to weather and, you know, kind of environmental constraints and where you have backups in different parts of the world. So there's different ways to think about redundancy too, that there are some surprising places where you'll find redundant practices done.
Even right down to what happens on the board and not just duplicating systems?
Absolutely. And so, yeah, that's the concept. Even some components are designed with redundancy built into them, or at least fail-safe modes. And so if something fails, it doesn't fail catastrophically, which is, again, back to your risk tolerance.
Sure. Well, I think the takeaway here is understand your risk tolerance, because this is certainly the case in finance, but I guess we don't really think of it as being the case in electronics, but I think people massively underestimate their own risk tolerance. And then when it happens to them, whatever it is, whenever it happens to them, suddenly they start to overestimate how much, how conservative they should be.
Yeah, we're really bad just in general at risk, you know, mitigation assessment. I mean, you see it all over the news, right? One incident will happen on the news and then all of a sudden everybody's terrified it's going to happen to them. But yet we get in our vehicles and drive every day when that's one of the most hazardous things, you know, you can do as a person. We think nothing of that as a risk. And so, you know, part of it is, you know, it's just not part of our everyday, you know, thinking or practice that way. But
well, we're getting to the edge of our time allocation at the moment, but I think I'd like to wrap up with some words of wisdom from you as far as what can maybe newer designers, as we, you know, the industry undergoes this kind of generational shift, what can newer designers do to educate themselves on reliability challenges, modes of failure, what they can do in their designs to ensure that they don't run into the types of problems where the manufacturer now has to call you in order to fix it after it's already failing.
Well, point number one, we've talked about several times, you know, so far is, you know, understand what you're really trying to design for. What does that really look like, you know, from your customer standpoint, not yours, but your in-use customer? What do they think is tolerable and acceptable, and what are they going to need? And then don't go it alone. There's so many resources out there. That's been one of the nice things, you know, about the explosion of webinars and podcasts. There are a lot of resources, you know, to go out and do some general education. There's, you know, the industry standards themselves, you need to become familiar with. There's lots of professional societies, SMTA, IPC, INEMI, you know, that are both some that are targeted to specific industries, as well as some that are broad-based. And then, you know, partner, you know, if you're designing for something, the more you can get early involvement and early feedback from other people, the more successful you'll be.
I think that's all great advice, and I like what you said about joining certain professional societies. I definitely agree. I think designers, anyone who's going to do this professionally, whether they're at the design side or the manufacturing side, should be members of some kind of professional society, because it's excellent for continuing education. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a real treat, and it's certainly good, selfishly, for myself, because the manufacturing process and things like quality control and reliability are all areas where I've tried to educate myself at a deeper level, and I think a lot of other designers need to do that as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And to everyone out there listening, make sure that you subscribe to our YouTube channel. Make sure you hit that like button. And of course, you will be able to keep up with all of our upcoming episodes. We're going to have some great links in the show notes, so you can go learn more about what Cheryl does, and you can go learn more about reliability in electronics manufacturing. That's all we have for today. Thanks for joining us, folks. Don't stop learning, stay on track, and we'll see you next time.